Metal Podcast, episode 86.
Greetings and welcome to the Thomas Coffee Metal Podcast. I'm your host, Don Cardenas, and I hope you've been having a fantastic week. Now, I'm very much looking forward to this next week because I am taking the week off. I am going to be shutting down social media. I'm going to be not scheduling any recordings and, well, I'll still be drawing and doing stuff like that. I'm not going to have a lot of pressure on it. I'm going to relax, spend some time with the family, probably watch a whole lot of TV and stuff, and hopefully catch up on some fun things like Miss Marvel and maybe finally finish the Boba Fett show and watch Obi-Wan and, you know, I don't know, just watch a whole bunch of stuff and just kind of sit back and consume and read a whole bunch of comics and just kind of recharge. You know, I was kind of burnt out at the beginning of June, and I tried to take a little bit of a break, and while it helped, I'm still just feeling kind of crisp, you know? So I'm really looking forward to this next week and all that. That said, things are still happening. Things are still super busy. You know, I'm still trying to wrap up the first issue of Evie and the Helsings so Steve, Bryant, and I can get the Kickstarter rolling and be cool with that. Working on some other projects. The Spend the Night comic that I finished back in June from Jackie Kong and all that Kong comics will be out soon. I think we're waiting for the printer. I'm not involved in the publishing end of it, but supposedly the prints are supposed to be coming, and yeah. So there's that. I got a really cool guest spot on my buddy Kevin Mellon's cover of a Soundgarden song that will be coming soon. We'll be doing a video for that. That'll be really fun. Working on some videos for the Patreon. So yeah, I'm busy. I'm doing stuff, but I don't know. I think I just need to take another couple steps back for a little bit and kind of just recharge. So, you know, I hope you can find time for yourself to do something like that and kind of recharge. And yeah, it's summer. Let's try to enjoy it a little bit, I guess. All right, enough of that. Let's get to our recommendations.
Oh, hello, fellow humans. You caught me in the middle of drinking coffee while reading comics and listening to metal. Do you ever get curious about how your favorite creators get their inspiration? Have you ever wondered what led them down this path? Well, join me, noted comic book heartthrob Grant Stoy, as I do deep dive interviews with some of the best comic book folks around on Into the Comics Cave. Each week we examine a creator's history and find out stuff like where they grew up or whether or not birds with lips are sexy. You can find us on Apple, Stitchers, most anywhere you stream your podcast. Now back to my favorite hugger in the world, Don Cardenas.
All right, for my music recommendation this week, I have Vaxis 2, A Window of the Waking Mind by Coheed and Cambria. Now, if you've been listening to the show, you know I've had big Coheed and Cambria fans, Heather Antos and Steens on, and they were both very big fans of Coheed and Cambria. I am a passing, I don't know, fan, call it, but there's a couple songs I really like, and the rest just never really hit me. But I decided with this new album coming out, I'm going to give it a shot. I'm going to sit down, give them a fair shot, considering I spoke to both of them, and they were very, very much, you know, the passionate fans. So I figured there's got to be something there I'm missing, or maybe my taste has changed or opened up enough to where I can really appreciate it. And yeah, it's a fantastic album. Now, I will say it is a tiny bit of a stretch to call it like full-on metal, but they definitely have enough big riffs and enough songs in their entire catalog to where I feel it's safe to say they can be lumped in or named a metal band safely enough. This album is... It's kind of a ride. It opens kind of mellow. And there's definitely, you know, lots of more mellow parts to this than there would be in a typical metal album. But I've also reviewed and recommended a bunch of metal albums that were pretty chill. So it's just, yeah, it's one of those things, I guess. But yeah, there's a ton of stuff on here. I was really enjoying the album, but then I got hit with the middle of the album, or I guess the early middle of the album, because there's 13 tracks on here. But tracks 4, 5, and 6, Shoulders, A Disappearing Act, and Love Murder 1, those three hit me, and I'm like, all right, I am fully in. Shoulders, I think by far, is probably the most metal song on the album. But that's not to say it doesn't have a huge, huge chorus and a bunch of hooks. But the riff on that is one of the best riffs I've heard in quite a bit. Really, really, really great stuff. Disappearing Act, that is a very, I guess, it contains a lot of the stuff I like in other metal acts, like, you know, Spirit Box or something like that, where it's kind of just a more mellow, kind of a groove type thing. And it really works when coming right after Shoulders, and then Love Murder 1, definitely a big rock song. And yeah, just this album is full of big hooks, you know, a few big riffs, lots of great melodies, and I think it's definitely opened up my ears a bit more to the Coheed and Cambria sound. So, you know, looking forward to stepping back and, you know, checking out some more of their other albums. So, yeah, I can definitely recommend this. If you like, you know, some good old rock with some metal tinges and also, you know, some chill moments, this is definitely something for you to check out. Let's go with, well, my favorite track, obviously the most metal one, Shoulders. Let's start with that, and yeah, I think you'll agree, this riff's pretty killer. So, Vaxxis 2, A Window of the Waking Mind, Coheed and Cambria, out now. My comic recommendation this week. I'm pretty sure I talked about this before, but it's out now in a new package, and I definitely think it's worth a revisit, or just worth mentioning again in case you haven't checked it out yet. And that is Murder Falcon from Daniel Warren Johnson. Now, I had Daniel on the show a couple episodes ago. Fantastic creator, fantastic guy. And this book is, it's metal as hell, but it's also full of heart and crazy action, and just really, really, really fun, really, really intense. And it is out now in a deluxe edition hardcover. I said that weird, deluxe edition hardcover. And yeah, I picked it up from Challengers Comics online because, one, they're buds and I want to support them, and two, they had an edition where it came with a book plate and it was signed by Daniel Warren Johnson. So even though I know Dan, it was nice to have the extra little book plate, and I'm not a huge guy on wanting signatures and stuff, but it's nice. If I was going to buy it, might as well get the one that the guy signed, right? So, just to give you a heads up, in case for somehow you have not heard of Murder Falcon, the world is under attack by hideous monsters, and Jake's life is falling apart until he meets Murder Falcon. Murder Falcon was sent from the Heavy to destroy all evil, but he can't do it without Jake shredding up a storm. Now, if, you know, a giant cyborg-looking Murder Falcon fighting monsters while someone's shredding in the background doesn't sound like it's up your alley, then I don't know what you're doing listening to this podcast, but it is definitely a sight to behold. But in typical Daniel Warren Johnson fashion, it is also supported by a fantastic story with a great message, a lot of heart, and it'll mess you up a little bit. It'll mess you up a little bit, but it's the good, you know, the good intensity, the good, you know, heart crushing kind of stuff. And I don't think I need to sell you on Daniel's art. He is one of the people these days that just nails, you know, how to portray action and especially music and the intensity it can bring when you're listening to some good old metal. So there's tons of stuff in here. Definitely check it out. I'm going to put a link to the Challengers Comics hardcover in the show notes because they still have some copies left, and it is definitely worth it to get the extra book plate and the signature and all that. So yeah, definitely check it out. Murder Falcon Deluxe Edition Hardcover.
Hey there, I'm Liana Kangas, and I'm actually the co-host of Comics Inebriated, a podcast about current and past events for history and weird facts about comics, pop culture. And all the while, we actually sit down with our fun special guests and have a quick drink. And one of those guests is actually Don of this very podcast. So come over, come hang out, come listen to it, and enjoy your time for the rest of this podcast.
All right. I have a coffee recommendation this week. I was gifted a bag of the Utica Coffee Freight House Blend from my buddy and former guest, Michelle Abinader. She sent that along with, we were exchanging some stickers and stuff, and she went ahead and went above and beyond and sent a whole bag. And my wife and I were super appreciative of that because it is some delicious, delicious coffee. She had mentioned Utica Coffee on the show. I was kind of thinking about ordering some, and yeah, so I didn't have to, but I'm gonna have to after drinking this because this stuff was really, really good. It's noted on the website of having molasses, dark berries, and a syrupy body. And no, normally like a berry flavor in a coffee isn't my jam. I don't know what dark berries are supposed to taste like, but apparently delicious. The suggestion for this is to blend it in a French press, which I did to test it out, and it was really, really good. But in, you know, the standard drip coffee maker making a full pot, really, really tasty as well. Like, this is definitely like an all-day coffee. There is never a point where it wasn't good. It held up all day in the pot. Typically, when I'm drinking coffee, my wife and I will make a full pot, and I'll have a couple of cups in the morning, and then towards the late afternoon or evening, both of us will usually have our third cup, and that'll be the pot. And by the end, you know, sometimes the coffee can get a little less than great. Not bad, but less than great. But for this one, it really, really held up. You know, just sitting in the pot all day, it's still really, really good. So, yeah, I'm definitely going to be ordering some more of this. Thank you again to Michelle for sending along the bag. I appreciate it very, very much. And you should definitely check it out. The link will be in the show notes. The coffee, Freight House Blend. Highly recommend. That rhymed, not intentional, but we'll leave it. Real quick before the interview begins, there was some weird audio stuff where the recordings just kind of dropped out. I did my best to kind of stitch everything together to make it as cohesive as possible. And to be honest, you probably wouldn't notice without me mentioning it. But in all fairness, I think I should mention it. So that way, in case anyone does notice anything funky, yeah, I was aware of it. Tried to fix it. Them's the breaks sometimes, I guess. But it's a fantastic guest. It's a great interview. I don't think you're going to lose anything. So yeah, just know that. And thanks for bearing with me on this. And yeah. Let's get to it. All right, it is now time for my guest. Today I am joined by the amazing writer, Erica Schultz. Erica, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Erica, you're a very prolific writer. You've had your hands on lots of interesting projects, from Bylines and Blood to the upcoming Deadliest Bouquet from Image Comics, and some Moon Knight coming from Marvel. But before we get into any of that, I have to ask, Comics Coffee Metal, what are you digging right now?
In terms of comics, I've been really bad about keeping up with everything that's coming out immediately. So what I've been doing is I've been saving up all my Marvel points and getting like back issues of stuff. So the Jason Aaron, Doctor Strange that, Jason Aaron written Doctor Strange that just came out like about a year ago, or 2 years ago, rather, I jumped on that. I just got an Obi-Wan Kenobi package because my husband and I are doing a rewatch of the Clone Wars. So I was like, oh, yeah, we should totally read that. Coffee, I don't really drink very much coffee. I think I asked my husband what he puts in the coffee pot, and it's, I believe, Seattle's best hazelnut flavor that he gets at Wegmans. Shout out to Wegmans. and metal, I've been so bad when it comes to just like listening to music. I've gotten to this stupid mindset where I'm like, well, if you're sitting down and you're lettering, you should be learning something too. So why not listen to a history podcast to learn something? But when I was like in high school and college, I was a big Metallica fan. And in college, a friend of mine, shout out to Jimmy Bucket, he got me into Sick of It All.
Okay.
I don't know if you know that band, but
I'm familiar with them. Yeah.
Okay. So that's who I would listen to in like high school and college and stuff. But yes, I've been so terrible when it comes to just like sitting down and like putting on the radio and like listening to actual music. Cause I'm like, no, I have to listen to a history podcast and try and broaden my horizons and make myself sound smarter.
I 1000% understand that. It's very difficult for me sometimes to just, you know, sit down and put on some music. And I'm like, I have to learn something. You know, I have to put on some sort of like guitar thing where it's like, you know, teach me about mixing or, you know, all the stuff that comes with recording and all that, or learning something new or whatever. Like there's not a ton of stuff where I'm like able to, yeah, there's not a ton of like drive sometimes to like sit down and pick out music and play. Cause sometimes I feel like I'm picking the same stuff over and over again anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing is like, you end up picking the same exact stuff and it's like, are you really broadening your horizons or are you just sort of like falling back on what you consider are your old standbys? Like yeah. I can listen to, you know, Led Zeppelin anytime, anywhere, and just, you know, and that's my old standby or even like some old Aerosmith and stuff. But it's like, you know, I know all of that. I can quote every song, you know? So maybe I should open myself up to thinking about other things. When I was teaching at the Hubert School, my students would be like, oh, you should listen to so-and-so. I'm like, who are these people? And they're like, they're like the number one people on the charts right now. I'm like, well, I don't listen to radio because I listen to podcasts about to try and learn things.
Do you do any of those like daily challenges like Wordle or Framed?
No.
Okay.
No.
There's one called Hurdle. Where it plays like a second of the intro of a song, then you have to keep getting seconds added on as you like miss a guess or whatever. And there's some where it's like, oh man, I know this. And then there's some where it's like, I get to the end and I'm like, I have never heard of this person or this song in my entire life. And apparently this song is 15 years old and apparently popular enough to be considered to be on this thing. Like, I don't know.
I'm so bad at that because like, I don't do anything like that. The only thing that I do that challenges myself is like, I have, my mom grew up speaking Neapolitan dialect for Italian and I've always, and you know, and I speak a decent amount, but reading and writing has always been kind of bad for me because, you know, you're learning by ear. So I'm doing Duolingo to try and learn, you know, reading and writing in Italian. Like that's the thing that I do aside from, you know, listen to history podcasts and try and make myself sound, you know, highfalutin.
Well, one of the benefits of doing this show is I try to recommend an album every episode.
Cool.
Which means I have to find something to listen to, which means like the amount of things I've added to like my, I guess, music vocabulary has been, you know, hugely expanded. I was the type of person, like, I kind of listen to everything anyway, but I was never, like, outrightly against, like, oh, pop music, I don't care. It's like, if it's a good song, that's a good song. But I think in terms of metal, for me, metal is kind of like the best genre. I kind of define it as a medium of itself, because you can have so many different variations of metal. But I think I've expanded that so much. Like, there's stuff I never thought I'd be into that's like maybe like super harsh sounding to the average person. But that I've, now that I've like had to actively seek it out and do that, I'm grateful for that, because I've discovered three or four bands that I think are like, you know, one of those forever bands you have, you know, okay, I think this band's going to be one of the ones I'm going to be going back to all the time. And I understand the whole, like, you can play, you know, everything front to back. That's me with Metallica. Like,
yeah,
I can't put on a Metallica album. Like, and I think once every 2 years, I get the itch again. Like, okay, I'll listen to all the albums once and then I'm done again. Cause I'd listened to them so much in high school. In high school, I completely ingested it. It was just everything. Every like free moment I had that wasn't, I was watching the videos or listening to the music or whatever. And
I mean, like, how many times have you watched Johnny Get Your Gun? I mean,
to be honest, once.
You only saw the movie once, really?
I only saw the movie once, but I've watched the one video probably hundreds of times. So.
Yeah, it's a creepy movie, though, I'll be honest.
Yeah, there's a reason I only watched it once. It was like, it was very unsettling. Like, yes. It was one of the first movies, to be honest, when I was younger, I'm like, oh, black and white movies, whatever. It was like one of the first movies where, like, even though it was in black and white, I'm like, oh man, this shit's like intense.
Yeah. It is, you know, because it's kind of like, well, I mean, the big thing that we used to do, which was the stupidest thing in the world, is you would rent Faces of Death.
Yeah, I remember that.
And like, and it was one of those things where it's like, oh yeah, you know, try and get through it. And it was almost like a dare, you know? But yeah, I've seen it a couple of times, but yeah, it's a very intense movie. And it's not like a feel good movie by any stretch of the imagination.
No,
like,
no,
there's no way you're turning that film off and going like, wow, the world is hopeful. Nope.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Since you brought it up, I will mention, you're only a handful of years older than me. So, you know, you're around the same age as my older brother. So therefore, you know, I have experience with the Faces of Death phenomena and all that. And yeah. I didn't make it through the whole movie for that. But I had to stop when they started cutting animals. That's when I looked away.
I couldn't do that. And it's like, that's when, you know, because you... It, at least in my group of friends, you'd have like 8 to 10 people, and we would all be crowded in somebody's living room or in somebody's basement watching it. And I'm like, okay, if there's that many people here, then I can hide behind somebody when the crazy shit happens.
Yeah. Unfortunately for me, it was the, you know, sneaking the video in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
by myself. So it definitely upped the creep factor of all that, but. Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
And then come to later, you know, learn later on, like many, many, many of those were faked. And
oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing, is you thought you were so cool, like, for sitting through it. And then you're like, oh, it was all like just bullshit snuff. Okay, great.
Yeah.
What I waste that Saturday night for.
Exactly. So, you know, I mentioned kind of like my obsession with Metallica and all that. Did you have anything like that when you were growing up? Like, was there like a band of us? A movie or something that you just kind of like, just kind of overwhelmed you for a time.
A New Hope definitely overwhelmed me for the most part. I mean, like, my mom was, you know, almost 9 months. She was like 8.5 months pregnant with me when she took my brother to see A New Hope. So I'm always like, I was there. and I remember waiting in line for Empire, and I remember waiting in line for Return. So, I mean, that, and my family was like very sci-fi. Like, my dad used to read, like, all the Asimov books, you know, all that whole thing, like, Three Body Problem, like, all of those, any possible sci-fi book my dad would read. We grew up watching, like, the old cheesy Flash Gordons and Doctor Who, and my mom used to be, used to do spot illos for Star Trek fanzines and stuff. So, like, we were a pretty sci-fi heavy family. So Star Wars was pretty much like an obsession in terms of the movies we had, the record we used to listen to the record. Yeah, now I'm really dating myself. We used to listen to the LP on the hi-fi. My God, these are things that there are people who don't even know what these things are anymore, you know? It's so weird.
They got Google. They got Google. They can figure it out.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, like, that was kind of like an obsession for me. And I had the biggest crush on Harrison Ford because, you know, who doesn't want to have a crush on Han Solo? I mean, it's Han Solo. He's a scoundrel. And so, like, that was a big sort of obsession. And also, I mean, I loved, I've said this a million times before, like, I loved, like, all the major 80s things. Like, I loved G.I. Joes, and I loved the Star Wars action figures, and I loved My Little Pony, and Transformers, and I used to, like, Legos came out with, like, a big medieval castle set, and it was, like, the one big Christmas gift that I got, so I built this medieval castle set, and it became Cobra's stronghold, and so we didn't have any of the G.I. Joe, like, airplanes or anything because they were way too expensive. So my Pegasus from My Little Pony was my G.I. Joe air support.
Awesome. Awesome.
And the unicorns could teleport. So they would, like, teleport in with, like, bandoliers of grenades to be able to take out Cobra. As, like, you know, Lady J is riding a Pegasus over, you know, the Lego castle stronghold, you know.
You know, this brings back lots of fond memories for myself, mixing my G.I. Joes and my Ninja Turtles and my Transformers and just combining everything. Everyone was involved in the story to make up for what you didn't have. And being the father of two, my daughter recently turned 6, and, you know, I kind of had that, you know, like, do kids do that anymore?
I don't know.
Like, I don't see a lot
do
of
do they
kids
even use that. Their imaginations anymore? Like, all I see is my nephew on his Switch playing Minecraft. Like, that's all I see.
And I know there are, because, you know, I talk to other, you know, comic dads, and, you know, they have their kids with their toys and all that. But we started, you know, last summer we started visiting my parents' house because, they live about 30 miles or so away from us. So I went, you know, like, one day every couple of weeks I'd go over there, and they found my old toys. And all of a sudden, like, you know, my then 5-year-old is, like, playing with my medieval spawn.
That's awesome.
That I had, putting them. She had the Violator toy, and, who she calls Boss, and his name is Boss now. And
that works.
He's like operating the Millennium Falcon, and that I had that I got after the special editions came out. And I'm just, like, thinking, like, yeah, kids still do that.
Good. Yeah, right. I mean, like, and but it's interesting because, like, you see the creativity in different ways, because, like, I'll go and I'll babysit my nephew and he'll be, you know, playing Minecraft, but he's in this, like, certain version of Minecraft where he's just, like, building things. Mm-hmm. So he's, like, building a house and he's building a stronghold and he's building, you know, all this other stuff, and, you know, oh, you got to put a torch here because the zombies are coming and stuff. So, I mean, there's a level of creativity that comes with it to begin with. It's just not, you know, the same type of imagination that, you know, we kind of had. But, you know, imagination's imagination. At least he's, you know, using his brain.
No, for sure. And I know I've spoken to quite a few parents who kids are, like, you know, really into Minecraft and all that, and they're like, you know, more than a handful of them were like, I'm like, this is wasting all this time on this. And then I see the stuff they make in there, and it's, like, really cool. It's like these, like, structures and all these things. And I'm like, yeah, that's really neat. I think, you know, we probably have that nostalgia for the tactile nature of holding the toys and doing all that. And I'm sure if we got, you know, my daughter access to a Switch, she would definitely, you know, probably, who wouldn't? I would, you know. I can't pretend like I didn't, like, you know, drop my toys the minute, like, Super Nintendo came out.
My brother worked at a store. My older brother worked at a store that's the closest thing that to now is like a Best Buy, but it was called Nobody Beats the Wiz. And he was like an assistant manager. And I remember one Christmas he came home and he got us a Nintendo. And it was like, my brother's like 5.5 years older than I am. Mm-hmm. So like he's, you know, 18 and I'm like 12, 13. And he comes home with this Nintendo and we're just like, holy crap. Like, you are a god. Like, you used to be the best because I would steal all your comic books, but now you really are the best.
Yeah, my oldest brother is, or my one of my older brothers, who's still at the house when I was around. He's, what, 5 years? Just, yeah, about the same age. So he would have, like, and he was really into electronics and technology and all that, so we would always have, like, he would always get the thing for his big present for the year or whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, our first computer was actually fairly decent and upgraded often because he wanted to keep messing with it and all that. And same thing with the, I remember all of us waiting for him to come home with Mortal Kombat.
Because back in the day, kids,
yeah, you had to like go to Toys R Us. You had to pull a ticket out of a little sleeve, give it to the guy, so they would go in the back and then pull out for you, unless you pre-ordered it. But even then, like, it was insane. And just, yeah, I love the immediacy of how we have things now, but I also kind of miss the anticipation things now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, I remember, you know, my mom was waiting online to get me and my sister a Cabbage Patch doll or something like that. Like, I mean, you want to talk about, like, you know, people standing around waiting, you know, you get your ticket and then you have to do that. I mean, that was insanity. But I mean, I miss that. I miss the fact that you have to wait. And it kind of helps the anticipation, which is why I think it's very funny, because when everybody got like the whole, when everything was like streaming and you could binge, everybody kind of got spoiled. And then when like certain series would come out and they'd be like, oh no, they're doing it on a weekly schedule. Everybody was like, what? I can't believe that. And it's like, well, that's how broadcast TV has always been. Like, yeah.
I love it that way. I love being able to binge something for sure. But like when Marvel and a bunch of those places, they do the weekly drops, I kind of like that too, because it gives, you know, mainly for someone who's online a lot, a chance to like catch up to everybody else.
Yeah. I mean, I still haven't. I saw all of Obi-Wan. I saw all of Moon Knight and all the other Marvel shows, but I haven't started watching Ms. Marvel yet, and I want to watch it, but I also want to be able to like binge it a bit or watch more than one episode at one time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think is it going to be 6 or 8 episodes? I don't remember.
It's 8.
But I mean, what I was going to do was I was going to wait until when I get back from San Diego and then binge it all, the whole thing. So. Although it's San Diego, that's probably going to get spoiled already.
My wife's taken her week off in a couple weeks, and I'm trying to line up myself to have some days off as well, so I'm not, you know, trying to get done too. So I think we're definitely going to end up binging that. We're way behind on the Star Wars stuff. Like, she's got a very, like, she loves The Mandalorian, but everything else, she's like, eh, you know, it's... She's not super into it, but we're watching Boba Fett right now, and very sporadically because it's not really grabbing us. But I know there's like a section in the middle where it just becomes the Mandalorian for a couple episodes, I'm told.
Yeah, the last two episodes are I heard a rumor. I don't know if it's true, so I don't want to. So I'll tell you this, but I don't know if it's true. So I heard that I saw the last two episodes, and the last two episodes are virtually all Mandalorian. Like, I don't even know why they were doing them for Book of Boba Fett, but I heard it's because the last two episodes of Book of Boba Fett were very contentious, and they needed to run something, so they had already had the Mandalorian episode, so they just said screw it, and they ran the two episodes that would have been running for season three of Mandalorian.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's what I heard. I don't know if it's true, but you know, comics people, they make shit up all the time.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So,
probably a lie.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to Ms. Marvel, though. I wasn't super into Moon Knight, but Moon Knight was never my guy. And while this seems like a perfect segue to start talking about your Marvel work, I do want to backtrack a second and ask you, were you excited when the special editions of Star Wars came out in the mid-90s?
No. And I'll tell you why. Because to me, I understand as a creative wanting to make things perfect. Like, I'm not even joking. I spent 4 hours today picking fonts for my next creator-owned book. That is way too much. And so I understand George Lucas's obsession for perfection. But first of all, Han Solo did shoot first. And I don't care. That is a hill that I will die on. Second of all, some of the changes that he made were so arbitrary that the only person that it made a difference to was him. And I felt that that was so self-indulgent, like to the point of just like, how egocentric are you? You know, you know, you have so much money that you're turning around and you are making all these like incredibly self-indulgent changes. I'm just like, whatever. So I wasn't a huge fan of the special editions just because I didn't think that they were necessary. Because okay, to me, I thought there was no such thing as a perfect film, but I thought that what we had was, you know, I mean, yes, you look back, you can, you know, drive a Mack truck through plot holes, but it wasn't about that. It was about the sort of grand nature of the story. And I think what's happening now, and I was having a conversation with my friend Daryl about this, I think the problem with a lot of things right now, aside from the fact that it's all like nostalgia porn, is that nothing is new is being done. Like the three new films that the newest trilogy was just basically a rehash of the original trilogy. The prequels were so self-indulgent and, you know, were just awful simply because George Lucas wasn't doing it for anybody but himself, pretty much. Like, he says he made them for kids, but it doesn't really matter. Like, the performances from these very good actors were awful because he was more concerned with the way things looked versus the actual storytelling. And as a storyteller, that kind of breaks my heart a little bit. But there's so much rehash, like everything is a rehash of, you know, you have the reluctant, like just take Mandalorian. You have the reluctant hero, and I know it's all Campbell's hero's journey. I get that. I used to teach that. Like, I know it pretty damn well. But it's all a hero's journey. It's all the reluctant, you know, weathered guy taking in a young upstart, whether it's Luke Skywalker or Baby Yoda or, you know, whomever. And, you know, watching their character change and this, that, and the next thing. Did you watch Obi-Wan?
No, not yet. We have not seen that. Okay. I've been aware of some things about the like him having a relationship with Leia and that kind of like back and forth.
But Well, it's literally, it's the same thing. You have the reluctant older mentor taking in the young upstart. I mean, it's formulaic, and it's gotten to the point where it's just insert whatever character here into this exact formula. And it's frustrating because I think that there are so many other stories that they can tell, that they choose not to, because I think on one hand, they're quote playing it safe. Like the bean counters are, you know, want things to make money, so they want to play it safe. But on the other hand, I think it's a sense of just like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But it is broke. You know, like from a creator's standpoint, and I know people can say, oh, she's just got sour grapes because she's not writing it. That's absolutely true. I would love to have the opportunity to write these things. But I think it's very formulaic, and I think it's very limiting. So I would like to see more. I would like to see something more interesting, but that's just me.
No, I totally get it. You're someone who's, you know, you have the OG history with, you know, Star Wars, and growing up for me, like, I've seen Star Wars before the special editions and all that, but I never saw it in the screen, and I never, like, I was still young enough to where it's like, ooh, new special effects, like, it's gonna look even better now and all that. So it's like a lot of like these minuscule changes that he made that you know, original fans like yourself were like, why did he do that? Like, that just flew over my head. And that's
fine. I know I'm like, I'm such a negative person, I guess.
No. I'm not, you know, putting this all together as a negative. I'm just, you know, kind of relaying my experience. But as I've gotten older and all that, I've definitely been on the train of like, well, I would like to see the original again. Cause I do remember, we had a tape of it for, you know, however long ago, but no one in my family knows where this tape is, but we had, I think, the first two on videotape at the very least, sure, pan and scan, but still, you know, it's another thing kids these days aren't going to understand.
Oh yeah.
when you send your parents to get you to get the video of the latest movie you want, make sure they get the letterbox version.
Yeah. Otherwise it's pan and scan.
Yeah. They have it so easy these days.
Oh my god!
I do like Mandalorian a lot. But I understand it's all tropes. It's all, you know, this what's been done before. But I like how it does it. So
I also hate Baby Yoda, and I know that makes me a horrible human being.
Well, I understand why you would hate it as a parent. I'm like, these writers obviously had a toddler before. they know what a toddler does and how you react to a toddler. Where you're like, what are you doing? Oh my god. And then you're like, all right, come.
You know, it's like for me, and this is, I'm the first person to admit this, you can tell that I'm not a parent. I really dislike the trope of the character, the infantile character whose only purpose is to screw something up so the hero gets put into another situation. So here's a case in point. Even in something as epic as Lord of the Rings, and I'm going to talk about the films and not the books, even though I've read the books. You know, in Fellowship of the Ring, you have Pippin being that idiot, you know, and that really annoyed the hell out of me. Although Pippin has his own arc that you then later see, and he gets mature, and he's, you know, he's stuck with Denethor and all that other stuff. But you have this, or look at Carl from Walking Dead. You know, you have the idiot child who does something really stupid, and the hero has to get off of their path to then go and save the kid because, you know, Carl went into the big creepy haunted house or whatever. It's just, for me, it's kind of frustrating. And I'm just like, god damn it, just chain the kid to a freaking radiator or something. Like, come on. You know, So I know that that's absolutely, Dyfus is going to be called on me just for saying that.
No, I get it though. I get it. It's one of those things where, you know, I think, you know, parents can be like, oh yeah, I get it. You know, like, and also, but also like, I've been in that position before where the child does something unexpectedly, does something crazy. And you're like, what is this?
Yeah, and I've babysat before, and yeah. I've got nieces and nephews and godkids and everything. Yeah,
there's been plenty of moments of like, what are you doing? What's going on? Why would you think this is a good idea right now?
Yeah, like where in your little tiny undeveloped brain did you think that this was, you know, the smart play? but for me, I look at storytelling and fiction and things like that as an escape and as a, not as an idealized version of things, but kind of, you know, as an idealized version of things. I was talking to a friend of mine today and we were talking about how, you know, it feels like there's no justice in real life, because he was saying how he loves, you know, like Law and Order and all these procedural dramas. And he says, yeah, because it feels like there's really no justice in life, but you can watch TV and they get the bad guy. You know, so mm-hmm. I know kids are unpredictable, you know, snot factories. I'd like to be able to watch TV where they're not unpredictable snot factories. If that makes sense.
I know 100%. It's
Don will never have Erica babysit his children.
Well, yeah, probably not. my daughter's pretty chill, but my son, he's. Anyway, he is a literal spitfire, like that boy. And it's only going to get worse. Sure, I told my wife, like, I was a little boy once too. It's only going to get worse, honey. It's only going to get worse.
And I'm sure she's sitting there going, shit, how much is divorce cost? No, I'm just kidding.
we joke about that, but we're like, nah, we wouldn't survive on our own.
I'm not even allowed to, you know, load up the dishwasher on my own. I don't think I'd survive. I'm always doing it wrong. I made a joke about like how, like, cause my husband, you know, he's got his shit together. He's a real adult. And I am too, to a certain extent. But like I made a joke that I was gonna do a comic strip called You're Doing It Wrong. And it's about a 45-year-old woman who everything she does is wrong, no matter what. So it's like, you load up the dishwasher. No, you're doing it wrong. It's like, no, it'll work fine. No. You have to put the plates at a 36 degree angle, you know, so the spitter, whatever, the sprayer hits it right and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, oh, Jesus Christ, I can't do all this. Just fine. Do it. So, you know, like, I'm not trusted to go grocery shopping, because I'll just come home with like Twinkies and like whipped cream. He's like, where's the rest of the actual food? It's like, oh, it's here. We can live off of this. It's fine.
Get protein in this. And yeah, you're good.
Yeah, exactly. I'll come up with like cottage cheese, berries, hot sauce, and like Twinkies or Oreos.
I mean, you got all your major food groups that you really need right there.
Exactly.
I think us creatives are, you know, we're adults, but maybe we might be a little bit of an asterisk next to it. You know, like we have certain quirks about about us, where maybe our creative section is, you know, drawing more of the brain power than some of our stable partners have.
My husband's a creative and a freelancer as well. So, you know, although his job is a little like, not like comics in the sense where you're like literally hopping from job to job and you're working on multiple things at once. You know, he has like a job for 9 months. Whereas I'm like, okay, I'm working on 17 different projects all at once. And let's see. And you have to make like your list of things to do about what are we going to work on today? You know, and I think that, you know, just if you are a freelancer, if you are a full-time freelancer, there is a certain amount of bandwidth that is used simply with figuring out what you're going to do for that day. You know, and I think to a certain extent, it's like, all right, well, what do I have to get done? And you got to look at your deadlines and things like that. So, I mean, I have that sort of head for business and, you know, and things like that. But at the same time, I'm just like, all right, some days I'm just like a total moron, you know, spending 4 hours looking at fonts. Like, come on, Erica. Really? I could have picked like the second font that I chose, but no.
You've had the opportunity to contribute to Moon Knight, Black, White, and Blood number 3. Were you a huge Moon Knight fan before, or?
When I learned that they were doing a Moon Knight anthology, I reached out to an editor at Marvel and I asked, you know, could you please give me the name of the editor for that anthology? And I reached out and I was given the opportunity to pitch, and I was really thrilled when they partnered me up with David Lopez, mm-hmm. who I'm a huge fan of. So
amazing.
Yeah.
I love his work. It's very, just something about it. It's very comforting. His lines are just like, even when he's, you know, drawing really rough stuff, it's just something oddly comforting about his line work.
He draws a very handsome Jake Lockley.
So you mentioned that you weren't a super big fan of the show. Was there any aspect of the show that you felt they got right? Or because, you know, as you mentioned, it's a character that's been rebooted multiple times. And usually when these shows come about, my wife kind of looks to me like, so what's his deal? And I'm like, well, it kind of changes. Like a creative team comes on, they have like a take on the character. It kind of does well for a while. It peters off. And then a year or two later, a different take and so on and so forth. So I don't know if there's really like the ultimate definitive take on Moon Knight. Is that aside from like, is there something on the show that, you know, you felt they got right? Is there like a definitive take of Moon Knight for you besides your own?
No, there is not a definitive take on him. And, I think that they, you know, more or less they've been looking at different ways to do him for years. I know that the show itself had seemed to, lean very heavily on the Jeff Lemire, Greg Smallwood run.
Mm-hmm.
And in more recent years, there has been a shift to Jake Lockley being sort of like the most violent and like the worst of the three, characters of, you know, between Mark, Steven, and Jake. And that kind of felt like it came out of nowhere. And the show seemed to lean toward that. And that always broke my heart a bit because my dad drove a cab in New York for a time. So Jake was always sort of like, you know, near and dear to my heart.
Mm-hmm.
So the story that David and I did for this anthology centers around Jake. And, you know, I mean, and Jake is no slouch, but he's not this like remorseless psychopathic killer that they seem to sort of want to portray him as of late. But that's just one girl's opinion.
Well, that's awesome. I'm glad you got a chance to like have a take on him, especially with your dad having been a cab driver. I always felt like that was like one of the most fun things about, you know, Moon Knight in terms of the MCU and all that, is just that, you know, Peter Parker, he's a photojournalist. Okay. And then, you know, he had like a real job though. He was a cab driver, and granted, you know, it wasn't, you know, from what I've read, I don't remember it being like, you know, a huge factor into everything, but it was still interesting. Like, this guy has a regular job. And
well, he didn't need to have a regular job. The thing is that yeah. Jake was the one who knew sort of the underworld.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew the sort of the unwashed masses. So the Jake persona was known as, you know, the guy who was sort of, you know, snooping around, but would get things done. So people would go to Jake and be like, hey, Jake, I've got a problem with so-and-so. And they knew that, you know, they didn't know that technically Moon Knight was going to be the one solving that problem, but they knew that they could go to Jake.
Okay.
So, I mean, at least traditionally, I'll say that, because again, things have been retconned a million ways to Sunday. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking like more like Don Heck, Doug Monch. I don't know how to pronounce his last name, and I'm
That's
sorry.
How I would. Yeah.
So that sort of, you know, 70s, early 80s run, even pre Sienkiewicz.
Okay. Well, I'll definitely have to check that out. Like, you had mentioned to me before that, you know, you're kind of like making your way through a lot of the older comics, you know, and I'm like mainstream comics these days. I am so far behind, years and years and years behind. I basically know enough just from osmosis from Twitter.
Yeah.
And the occasional article here and there, but I keep telling myself I should just get the Marvel app, pay for that for a while, catch up and do all that. But whenever I think about that, I kind of think about, like, I kind of just like to go back and read all these older stories. Like you just mentioned, like this older pre-Sienkiewicz Moon Knight stuff. I'm like, that sounds like more fun than like, oh, not that it's not going to be, it wouldn't be good or considered like a excellent series, but like that seems more interesting to me than going and saying, oh, let me start with Hickman's X-Men. Like, let me go back and it's like, what? How about I just read some like good old 70s Moon Knight? It sounds more relaxing to me.
Well, I mean, if you want to start, you have to start Werewolf by Night. But then there's the Moonlight collection that I think, I want to say there's like three volumes. I have them all digitally. And because, you know, when Marvel does like those big fat collections, DC does them too. And it collects all of the Moon Knight stories. So it starts with Werewolf by Night. It goes into when he has his own mini series, and it goes into like Defenders. It goes into like all the whole thing. Like when he has like a whole back and forth with Hellcat, during a Defenders run. Yeah, I mean, I would definitely start with those collections, and you just see, you not only see how the character changes, but you also start seeing how he becomes more than just this, like, assassin, because originally in Werewolf by Night, he was this assassin who was hired by this group called the Committee, which is, you know, kind of like, if you ever watched Young Justice, it was kind of like the Light. Okay. And so they hired him to track down Jack Russell, who was a werewolf, and like, you know, he was going to be paid like $10,000 to do that. And that was like where he originally came in. But then he started becoming like his own person as opposed to just sort of like a hired hand.
Okay. I had to chuckle myself because I keep forgetting Werewolf by Night's name is Jack Russell. And I miss that in comics sometimes.
Well, yeah, the Werewolf by Night is Jack Russell, and he's originally he's Mark Spector, and then the Stephen Grant and Jake Lockley personas come on later.
Okay. Yeah, just the pun of that is this.
Yeah.
Some people hate that stuff. I have fond memories. The first comics I read were the little digest size Ditko Leese Spider-Man collections that my brothers had. So a lot of that, my fondness for Marvel comes from that kind of era of just things, of the Stan Lee era, of the, you know, not, you know, looking back kind of hokey kind of stuff, but still, you know, got that the classic Ditko-ness to it and all that. So, yeah. Anyway, enough about that. So aside from that, because that'll be dropping in stores on July 20th, which will be the Wednesday after this episode drops. So if you're listening to this on the 15th, you have a few more days to make sure you go get that from your shop. You'll also have a trade paperback of your series Bylines and Blood coming out.
Yes, that is coming out August 3rd. I will say that if you're at San Diego Comic-Con, I will be doing a signing of Moon Knight at Now or Never Comics at 5:30 the Wednesday before. I mean, well, the cons open Wednesday, but Wednesday, July 20th, I'll be doing a signing at Now or Never Comics in San Diego.
Awesome. And you got that from Aftershock. And then right after that, you got Image series, The Deadliest Bouquet, number one coming out. Yes. Is this your first time working with Image?
No, I edited a book with Image, and I was part of the Where We Live anthology benefited the victims of the Las Vegas mass shooting. And this is my first time that I have a solo series with Image.
Okay.
So that, yeah.
Was working having that series at Image, was that something that was always one of those bucket list items for yourself, or were you not really, because some people I talk to, they don't really have like that, oh, I want to work for this and have a book here and do this. It's just like, I'm just going to do what's next and hopefully it works out well.
Well, I mean, I tend to be, my start in comics was, I started with a series called M3. I wrote a series called M3, and Vicente Alcazar was the artist on it. And we had pitched it to everyone under the sun, and everyone said no. So, I mean, my attitude has always been, fuck it, I'll do it myself. Mm-hmm. And so the Image book, The Deadliest Bouquet, I had originally had a publisher, and unfortunately when COVID hit, that green light got rescinded. And so I said, well, fuck it, I'll do it myself. And we did a Kickstarter for it, and we put it out instead of as single issues, we put it out as an OGN. And on a lark, I said, you know, why don't I just pitch it to Image just to see what they think? When I had most of the line art done already, and if not most of the colors. And Carilla Borelli was the line artist, and both Gab Contreras and Tom Chu worked on the colors. And they, you know, and I got a response back saying, you know, I did the standard pitch with, you know, 5 to 8 pages. Hey, we really like this. Do you have any more? I was like, yeah, well, you know, I pretty much have the whole rest of the book if you want to see it. So I sent that along, and they said, we really like to do this with you. You know, let's have a chat. So I was really excited because, even though we had a very successful Kickstarter, Kickstarters have a limited, they have a limited range. You know, so I wanted to see this book get into more people's hands. So I was really jazzed about that. And now it's going to be coming out as it was originally intended to come out, which was as a 5-issue series versus, you know, an OGN that was sort of broken into 5 chapters.
Okay. Well, that's, you know, if that's nothing, if not a lesson to everybody. you know, one door closes, you kick it open.
Well, that, you know, I understand. I mean, I've been rejected more times than I care to admit, and I understand that. And, you know, you want to talk about rejection? I've reached out to so many literary agents and, you know, gotten the rejection from them. So I get it. I get rejection. But there is a level of, there's a level of comics, of perseverance that I think people need to have in comics. And I think that, I mean, this is something that people don't really talk about, but if you want to do comics and have that be your career, your full-time career, which it is mine, there's a level of perseverance that you have that not a lot of people have. If you have a day job that pays your bills and you do comics for fun, God bless you. You know, that's great. And if that's how you're doing it, then who the hell am I to say there's anything wrong with that? There's absolutely not. And please don't let anybody tell you having a day job means you're not doing it right or whatever. Like, screw them. But this is what I do full time. I write, letter, and edit comics full time. So I kind of have to have that, all right, well, if you're not going to do it, I'm going to do it myself attitude, because otherwise it wouldn't ever get done. And one of the things that I know people don't talk about in comics is the fact that you have to constantly have output. So if you're an artist, you have to constantly be posting stuff on socials about whether it's commissions or new pages or whatever. If you're a writer, you have to constantly be saying, hey, I've got this new book coming out. You know, so if you don't have a publisher that's doing it, that's, you know, putting this book out, you got to do it yourself. And it's not easy at all by any means, but, you know, I kind of run on piss and vinegar. So
no, it's awesome that, you know, you're able to just get this book, not only have a successful Kickstarter, but also, you know, get that publisher interest and get into that larger audience, because you made a very excellent point with Kickstarters are great, but you get the book to the people who backed it, and that's it. And then after that, what? Granted, you could put it up on sale at your own shop or whatever, but to then, and I see this happening quite a bit now, is, you know, a lot of publishers, I don't think Image took this into account. I'm sure they saw the quality of the book and were like, yes. But I know a lot of smaller publishers are like, you do the Kickstarter, it's successful. They're like, okay, we're coming in and we're going to help you. We're going to, you know, put this out to the wider after the Kickstarter is all done.
But the work is already done.
Yeah.
The work's already done and the book's already paid for. And so the publisher, for lack of a better term, gets off easy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas, you know, whereas you're putting the book out yourself, like we were within a month of starting to ship the book out to the backers when I decided, you know, on a whim, let's just turn around and pitch it to Image. So the book was already paid for. The book was pretty much ready to go. So if Image said no, they would have said no, but there really was no risk in it for them. You know, like I think one of the main risks, especially in monthly books, is like getting everything done on time. Book's done. like I literally have the files like sitting, waiting, you know, for the email to come. Okay, we need issue whatever. Okay, boom, here's the files. They're already done. You know, so the risk is completely gone from them. And you know, I don't know if that was a factor in them greenlighting it. Maybe it was. I hope, or I would hope, that the main factor was the quality of the story and the quality of the book. But at this point, I'm not going to split hairs, you know?
Yeah. No, you bring up a great point. The work is done. And I think a lot of, you know, that's the uphill battle, is having the work done and being prepared to just have it ready for whatever thing. And I'm one of those people who, I don't make my full living from comics. You know, I have other things I do, but you know, I'm afforded the opportunity to my own creator stuff. I don't have to make sure I'm having a page rate with it now. Yeah. You know, I can work on it. Granted, I take on stuff that does have page rates and things like that, but even then, you know, the book I'm working on right now, going to be, you know, we're working to have it done before we even hit, like, you know, start, you know, spreading words about Kickstarters and stuff like that. And that's just such a huge hurdle, I think, for so many people. But I think it's also an important thing people need to try to consider and think of when they are doing their own independent comics and things like that, where, you know, I've definitely shot myself in the, you know, foot with this before, but like, have a thing done before you're, you know, really pushing it. Because when you're the one pushing it, because you're independent, you're gonna need all the time you got to get that done.
It's tough. I mean, I've taught a class on self-publishing and doing Kickstarters and stuff, and one of the things that people don't want to hear is, you know, yes, the Kickstarter is going to pay for the book, you know, for all intents and purposes, but you still need to lay out money up front to get some pages done to showcase on your Kickstarter, because people need to know what they're purchasing.
Yep.
You know, and I think that nobody wants to hear that. Everybody wants to hear. And the other thing is, everybody thinks Kickstarter is free money. It is not. You got to shake your ass hard for that money. You have to work hard for that money.
And it's taxed.
Well, aside from the fact that it's taxed, do you know how many people didn't know that it's taxed?
A majority. I want to say the majority of people. Like, when I had a failed Kickstarter a few years ago, and when I was talking to my co-creator about it, like, we were trying to figure out whose taxes were going to be the least affected by this, if it funds, like, who's going to take the bigger hit.
Well, that's the thing is, you know, I obviously don't know what it is for other countries, but in the US, like everybody saw the, you know, Kickstarters that make like, you know, $100,000 or whatever. Yeah. But that individual has to pay taxes on that $100,000. So yeah, you make 50 grand on your Kickstarter. Awesome. You're paying taxes on the 50 grand. We did just under $28,000 for the Deadliest Bouquet for the Kickstarter. And everybody was like, oh man, you got like 30 grand. That's great. It's like, yeah, but I have to pay money. I have to pay taxes on that.
Yeah.
You know? So you know, that's great. I could pay for the book, but yeah, it's not free. It's by no means free money.
Yeah. It's not, yeah. Sorry.
And people just need to realize that and accept it. You know, it's not the way the world works, unfortunately.
No, not in the slightest. And I, you know, it kind of does, you know, the having the pages done beforehand broaches that subject, something that I've seen come up. And I don't want to start discussing discourses of the comics medium, of the comics industry. But the idea of, you know, writers have to pay that toll to have art done and things like that. And, you know, it's being on the art side of it. It's like, yeah, I kind of need money to do a thing because I'm spending my time and all that. So it's part of that weird transactional thing, because also with so many comics, a lot of people are friends, and it's like, so, okay, cool. We're great. Let's make this comic together. Give me money. I need money to do the thing. And it's very generalized and a very simplified kind of dumb way of saying it. I know, but it's just kind of the thing where it's like, it is something though that needs to be taken account. If you're making comics, like I've considered writing a few things and you know, I coming from my own perspective, I'm like, there's no way in hell I'm going to ask anybody to do anything for free. Like if, you know, sure, I'll exchange bumps with fellow art friends for projects and stuff like that, or what have you, or exchange services at the very least. You know, I've done that before. But in terms of like, you know, wanting to have my own stuff that I've written drawn, I know in the back of my head, like, I'm going to have to pay for this. And that prevents me from doing a lot, because sometimes I'm like, well, I can't afford it right now. And, you know, but that all goes into, you know, I don't want to say how bad do you want it, because some people just can't afford it, and I understand that. And it's all part of a bigger subject, and I'm starting to get into the weeds on it, but it's definitely just something, you know, I think writers and artists both need to kind of like figure out.
Because I also think, you know, I've worked as an artist. I used to work in a studio. I used to do backgrounds and coloring and inking and everything like that. So I have that background as well. And I 100% empathize with that. At the same time, I think there is a misconception that writers just write a script, hand it off to an artist, and then, you know, pay, you know, hold the checkbook at bay, you know, a hostage. And I think that sometimes, you know, I remember having a conversation with an artist who said, I mean, what, it takes you like, what, a few hours to bang out a script? It's going to take me a few hours just to do one page. And I was like, no, it doesn't take a few hours to write a 22-page script. It takes a lot longer than that. Even if I'm firing on all cylinders, it'll take me a minimum of like 12 to 14 hours, minimum. And that's the first draft. And then you got to go back. So, I mean, I think that there is a common misconception on both sides of what the other person does. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I am in a very fortunate position. I am the first person to admit this. All the money that I make from work for hire comics literally gets funneled into my creator owned stuff. And what that can't pay for, it's a Kickstarter or I just say, okay, well, I can't do that project until I can pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I will do things to help the artists. Like, I'm working on a project right now and I've teased it, and Skylar Partridge had done, excuse me, I'm sorry. See, it happened again. Sorry, let me just take some water. San Diego is going to be great. All the panels that I'm on. Yeah. So I've taken it to a step where I'm very fortunate that I've done lettering, that I've done coloring and inking and everything. So if I'm working with an artist, I'll turn around and I'll say, okay, this is your rate. What can I do to help to maybe get your rate down? So I'm working with an artist on a project right now. Skylar Partridge has shown a sneak peek of the cover that she had done for it. The artist wanted a specific rate. I was like, okay, that's not in my budget. What can I do to help? And that artist was willing to come to my budget if I flatted the book.
Okay.
So that's what I'm doing. So they will do the line art. They will send it to me. I will do flats. I will send it back to them, and they'll do renders.
Mm-hmm.
But mind you, I'm also lettering the book, doing full production on the book and everything else.
Yeah.
So I know that there are writers that just write and that's all they do. I am not one of those writers. So to a certain extent, when it's the artist v writer or writer v artist discourse that happens on Twitter or whatever, I kind of roll my eyes at it, because I'm like, mm-hmm. look, I'm not that writer. I know that that writer does exist, but I'm not that writer. So I'm just staying as far the hell away from this as possible, because I don't want to get involved, because then I'm going to feel like I'm defending myself, and then it's going to turn into a whole thing. And yeah.
No, 1,000% I agree with you. It's a very stupid discussion. Every writer I have ever worked with busted their ass in so many other ways that, it's not just sitting down and writing. You become the marketer, you become the production person. When we're doing my first graphic novel, the writer, he was mainly the writer, but I did a lot of lettering on the first issue or the first chapter of it. I did all the production work. I did some of the on it. And knowing there's writers who are doing that kind of stuff to get the books done, I have a deep appreciation for that, because that shit takes time. That's frustrating and just stuff I don't want to do. And my page rate is fairly low, because I know independent writers are independent. So I want to make stuff with people. So I'm fortunate position where I can meet people in the middle with that. And the fact that you're like, what can I do to help? That's like huge. And just the fact that I know there's writers like that who just like, I write the script and that's it. But in my experience, from what I see, this like latest, generation of writers, of newer writers, these are all people who are like, okay, what else do I need to do to get this? Like, how do we get this done? And again, there's the outliers, but everyone's busting their ass. Everyone's working super hard. Making a comic book is fucking hard. And
it is.
As much as we love it, it's fucking hard.
And that's actually something that came up recently. This idea of, well, you love your job, so, you shouldn't complain about page rates or whatever. It's like, yeah, and that was both on a writer and artist level. Yeah. This sort of fan entitlement, well, you love your job, you get to do something really fun for your job, so be happy with what you have, kind of thing. It's like, yeah, well, I would love it if I could pay my mortgage with cookies, mm-hmm. but I can't. So I need to get paid for the work, whether it's lettering or editing or writing or whatever. You know, I mean, there's some artists that I have inked multiple times, I've done digital inks for. So it's just a matter of like, well, you need to get paid for your work. And I completely get that. And there are artists who I've worked with who would lowball me and would say, oh, X amount for a page. And I'm like, that's too low. My budget can afford more than that. So therefore I'm going to give you more because my budget can afford it. You know, and because, you know, I'm coming to you specifically to work with you. And I want to work with you and I want this to be a good experience and a fun experience. And I never, ever, ever want somebody to be like, oh, I worked with Erica Schultz and she was such a fucking bitch. Or I worked with her and she was the worst or anything like that. I never want that. You know, one of the sweetest things that I ever saw was Natasha Altarici, who I've worked with multiple times. She's done tons of covers for me. We did a few shorts together, but she was writing something out, and she said she was writing out a tweet. And she's like, "Erica's one of the best collaborators." I was like, "Oh my god, that just like makes me feel so much like wow." Because you said making comics is fucking hard, no matter what.
Yeah,
and you don't want to create any obstacles. You know?
Yeah, you want to be the person who's helping get done. And the fact that, you know, I know Natasha a little bit, and the fact that she would write that, I think it speaks volumes.
Yeah.
She doesn't suffer fools. No, she does not. So, you know, the fact that she just put that out there, like, Erica's one of the best collaborators to me, and to, I'm sure, many, many other people, were like, that's a factual statement then. That is not one person's opinion. That is a factual statement.
And to me, that's a huge thing because, yes, I'm primarily a writer, but I want people to know that I do have an art background. Like, I worked in a studio for, you know, almost 8 years. I was an art director in an ad agency doing graphic design, but I worked in a comic art studio for almost 8 years, you know, inking and lettering and, you know, doing colors and all kinds of shit. So I understand the plight of the artist, and there are times that an artist will give pages back to me and I'll have a change and I'll say, do you have time to make this change? And if they don't, then I'll say, okay, well, how about this? I'll take a crack at it and send it to you. And if you can bless it, then that's fine. Just look it over. And, you know, and what I always do is I always steal line from other bits because I never want to put my own line into there. Mm. I always want to make sure that because your line is your signature, you know? So if it's a matter of like, here's an example. So certain things are nitpicky when it comes to continuity issues in books. Yeah. So in one book I was working on, a character has a bad cut on their hand, and they have their hand wrapped up like with gauze. And sometimes the artist would be drawing something and forget to do the hand wrap. And so I would say, do you have time to go back and do that? If not, I could go to another page, steal the line work from that page, and just put it on the panel that you need. You know?
Yeah.
And I'll do that to make their life easier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because
that's a very smart way to do it, and a very, I think, respectful way to like help get things done, as we've been talking about, and still, you know, respecting the artist's time and work. And, you know, if I were in that position, you know, as I was like, oh, the gauze doesn't look right, I would probably just say, just draw the, if you want to, just go ahead and draw the gauze. You know, but for you to take that consideration of saying, no, it's your line. I'm going to do this. I'm going to, you know, trim it from here, paste it here, and it'll still be you. It's still you on the page. That's I think that's super respectful and cool of you. And, you know, therefore further solidifying Natasha's statement.
Natasha really is terrific and amazing to work with. So I'm very lucky that I've gotten a chance to work with her as many times as I have. So
awesome. Well, before we go, can we let everybody know what The Deadliest Bouquet is about? What's the pitch for it, and where can they? Well, I'm sure it's from Image, so I'll make sure the Diamond order code's in the show notes so they can try to get it pre-ordered and good to go. But yeah, I know what it is. It looks awesome, but let everybody know, what's The Deadliest Bouquet?
Okay, so the log line for it is, in 1998, three estranged sisters reunite to solve their mother's murder and try not to kill each other in the process.
There we go. It looks, one, the book looks beautiful. Two, you got amazing covers from, am I saying it, Carola?
Carola Borelli is the, she is the interior artist.
Okay.
The cover, issue number one has three covers. Adriana Mello is the A cover. Natasha Alterici, again, is the B cover. And Liana Kangas is the C cover. And then Adriana is doing the covers for the entire series. So issues two through five are going to have Adriana covers.
Awesome.
Chris Peter is the is coloring, I believe, covers two through five. I don't know. I don't believe Chris colored cover one, but Chris has been going to be coloring the other covers. And Image said that it was like Charmed and Charlie's Angels, which I can see, and especially since I did write the Charmed series for Dynamite several years ago, the comics for that. But I would say it's more like Clueless meets Knives Out.
Oh, okay. I like that one.
So it's more family drama and dysfunction than it is. You know, there is plenty of ass kicking in it. But it really focuses and goes deep in like the relationships between for each sister with each other and their individual relationships with their mom. So it was a dysfunctional family from the get. But then each sister sort of had their own relationship with their mom. And also, I mean, I'm one of three. And so I don't know if you're one of three, but there's an interesting dynamic when there's three, because it's always two against one. And that sort of round robin of alliances changes. Like I have an older sister and then my brother's the oldest. And there were times that it's like my sister and I would gang up on him, or he and she would gang up on me, or vice versa, you know, whatever. Yeah. And so they're really, you really see this sort of round robin of alliances and, you know, who is sort of ganging up on who. And you also see, you know, when you get together with, I mean, I'm in my 40s, my brother just turned 50 this year. So like when you get together with your family, everybody remembers the same thing differently, you know, and everybody's like, that's not how it happened. Yes, it is. And it's like, because everybody has their own personal attachment to it. So there are moments that you see that these sisters are talking about where, you know, one sister's really angry and it's like, you never stood up for me. And the visual that you see is, no, that's not true. You just felt like nobody was standing up for you. But the truth is that they really were. So the whole story is about sort of our own perception of our own history and how we're treated in our family and everything. So it's a lot deeper than just like shoot 'em up, kick some ass.
Yeah.
So I would say, yeah, Clueless meets Knives Out.
It looks awesome. And I do not know for the life of me how I missed the Kickstarter on this.
It's okay.
Because it looks right up my alley. The digital version that I always get with Kickstarters was right up my price point. Like everything is like, Why? What the hell was I doing that I missed this? but I'm really glad that it's coming out in Image. So I look forward to picking it up through there. And yeah, everyone should go check it out. Erica, it's been an absolute blast chatting with you. Hopefully I'll have you on again with the next big thing you got going on. And now is the time to let everybody know where they can find you on the internet.
I am on Instagram at Erica Schultz Writes, W-R-I-T-E-S. My website is ericaschultzwrites.com, and I'm mostly on Twitter at ericaschultz42.
All right. Erica, thank you so much again for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Comic Talking Metal podcast. Be sure to join me next week with my guest, Daniel Heister. See you then.